From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending 2005 by featuring a week of our favorite interviews of the year. On today's Fresh Air, Philip Roth talks about the two novels that made him famous, Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. This year, they were republished by the Library of America as part of a projected 8-volume collection of his work. Also, director David Cronenberg talks about his latest film, A History of Violence. The Village Voice Critics Poll just named it Best Film of the Year and named him Best Director. The film asks whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. Cronenberg's other movies include Scanners, Dead Ringers, The Dead Zone, The Fly, and Naked Lunch. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending 2005 by featuring a week of our favorite interviews of the year. This year, Philip Roth became the third living author to have his or her collected works published by the Library of America, which is dedicated to keeping in print the best American writing. The first two Roth volumes of his projected 8-volume series were published in September. They span the years 1959 to 72 and include the books that made him famous, Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. You can't accuse Roth of resting on his laurels. His latest novel, The Plot Against America, is a bestseller. I spoke to Roth about the Library of America editions, but he declined to do a reading. He's happy to talk about his early work. He just doesn't want to reread it. A heads up to parents of young children, during this interview, Roth talks about how he approached the subject of sex in Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. Let's start with your first book, Goodbye Columbus, published in 1959. Now, the novella in this book, it's like a novella and short stories, the novella in this book has so much to do with class. You know, the main character comes from a very working class family in Newark, and he falls in love with a suburban girl, a Jewish girl, who seems to be from another world because, you know, she plays tennis, she wears cashmere sweaters. And it's a world that I think in some ways seems less intellectual, more materialistic and shallow, but it's still so attractive to him. Could you talk about what encountering that class meant to you when you were young?
Well, I think...
Because you came, like your character, from working class Newark.
Yeah, that's right. Not from the fancy suburbs. I think when you're young, a class comes as a great surprise. Most people, I guess, begin to run into it as a surprise when they go to college, because in grade school and high school, you're usually with boys and girls who are from your own background. But when you go to college, there's a mix, and you meet people who are either poorer than you were or richer than you were. And I think one is very sensitive to that as a young person, someone between, say, 17 and 22 or 23. So, and I was not unusual in that respect. I too, was stunned by wealth, or what seemed to me to be wealth, and the differences between the way the wealthy lived, or the privileged lived, and the way we had lived. Not that I ever thought of my own background as poor. I think we were, actually, but I never experienced it that way. The house had everything I ever wanted, and the neighborhood was more or less homogeneous. But I think classes comes as a great shock, yes.
Perhaps the most talked about scenes from Goodbye Columbus have to do with the diaphragm. There's a scene in which the main character convinces his girlfriend to buy a diaphragm, and she says, why do we need it? You know, we're careful. And he says, for pleasure. And it becomes clear he's talking about for his pleasure, because, you know, he'd prefer to use that instead of a condom. And they argue about this a little bit, but they finally, agree to go to the Margaret Sanger Clinic, which she's heard about through reading Mary McCarthy books. And it seems very groundbreaking at this time to write about a sexual relationship in this kind of candid way, to actually address that birth control exists and that there are different kinds of birth control methods and that there are relative merits and disadvantages of each one. Did you feel like this was, you know, outside of Mary McCarthy, entering new territory?
It just seemed to me to be what was. That this is all takes place before Roe v. Wade, you know? There was no legalized abortion. Young men and young women were extremely concerned with the young woman not getting pregnant, because there was no recourse. Recourse generally in those years was marriage, especially between middle-class kids. So it was a crucial issue, because there was no remedy short of something drastic, which was either marriage for very young people, or an illegal abortion, which was quite terrifying if one even knew how to go about doing it. Therefore, there's a certain weight to that discussion that probably the book doesn't have any longer for contemporary young people. But at the time, it was truly a monumental subject that arose between a young man and a young woman.
Well, also one of the first things she's asked when she calls the clinic is she married? I mean, it was a really big step for a young woman then who was not married to go to a clinic and admit that she was having sex.
Absolutely. It may seem like a small thing now, but it really wasn't a small thing for Brenda, coming from her background, to do. It wasn't a small thing for him to ask her to do. It wasn't a huge thing, but there's a ripple on the surface there. Of course, they're undone by that because, as I remember, correct me, Terry, you read this.
Okay.
I haven't.
Go ahead.
I'll try.
I'll grade you on your accuracy about your own book.
Well, if I had written the book, I would have the diaphragm discovered by the mother who, because between the mother and the daughter in that book, there's a certain amount of hostility, ordinary sort of hostility between mother and daughter at that age. But the mother, I believe it's the mother, finds the diaphragm. And precedes the sort of argument that ends their affair. And Brenda feels that she can't, having been revealed, having had her true sexual nature revealed to her family, she becomes timid, or you might say she becomes sensible. I don't know. I don't interpret it myself. And she says to him, we can't go on with this. They don't. So the diaphragm isn't introduced in the story just to have the requisite diaphragm in the story. But the story turns on that decision and is resolved because of that decision.
Let's move on to Portnoy's Complaint, which is a book that so defined you in the first part of your career. It was published in, was it 1969?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 1969.
And the book is a novel, but it reads almost more like a really long riff on the subject of a young man breaking away from an overprotective mother and a kind of ineffectual father and becoming... You know, it was very absorbed, if not obsessed, with his own sexuality. That's kind of generalizing much too much and over-reducing.
No, I would just add, Terry, that it's told in the form of a monologue delivered to a psychoanalyst. And since sex is a central subject in psychoanalysis, that's why they're talking about it. He's not in a bar or in a classroom. So that's very important where it takes place and to whom he's speaking.
I know you don't want me to read from your book, but allow me to just read a couple of lines from his monologue to his psychiatrist. Look, am I exaggerating to think it's practically miraculous that I'm ambulatory? The hysteria and the superstition, the watch-its and the be-carefuls. You mustn't do this. You can't do that. Hold it. Don't. You're breaking an important law. What? Whose law? Doctor, these people are incredible. These people are unbelievable. These two, he's talking about his parents, these two are the outstanding producers and packagers of guilt in our time. They render it for me like fat from a chicken. Call, Alex. Visit, Alex. Alex, keep us informed. Don't go away without telling us, please. Not again. And so on. Mm-hmm. And he says to his psychiatrist, I can't stand anymore being frightened like this over nothing. Bless me with manhood. Make me brave. Make me strong. Make me whole. Enough being a nice Jewish boy, publicly pleasing my parents while privately pulling my putts. Enough. So what made you want to write it in that voice of, like, basically a long confession and complaint to mm-hmm. a psychiatrist?
Mm. Well, can I tell you a little bit of the history of how the book was written?
Please.
And I think that'll answer the question. In between 1960 and 1962, I was making a living by teaching in the writer's workshop in Iowa City. And I had among my students some Jewish students, and almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them at one point write a story in which there was an overbearing mother and an ineffectual father and an angry daughter or son, depending upon the sex of the writer. And I saw this thing repeated over and over again, and I thought, I'm face to face with folklore. This is a legend, a true legend perhaps, but the backgrounds of these people, and they were probably people born in 1940, I wasn't much older than they were, the backgrounds of these people all lead them to this legend, and I was impressed by the story. So I began by writing a short story, which I called A Jewish Patient Begins His Analysis. And it was published in Esquire magazine. And what I'm trying to get to is that there was not so much forethought in my writing this book, nor did I know beforehand what the hell I was doing. After I wrote that, I thought, go ahead. You found something there. What had I found? That in talking to the invisible analyst, or at least using that as the conceit, I had opened up my verbal floodgates, you know, that I could go further. Not only that, but that the psychoanalytic session gave me permission to speak freely of sex. I needed an opening that would permit me to write about things I knew about, that I knew I could be interesting about, but how? Where was I going to get the permission to do it? Reading Henry Miller gave me a certain kind of permission. He was marvelous, I thought, in the Tropic of Cancer. But aside from that, maybe Lolita in some small way, I didn't know anything in American literature where there was an open representation of the madness, say, of masturbation. It's mad. At any rate, I wrote this story about the character talking to his analyst about masturbating. And nobody wanted to publish that, and except a very unlikely magazine for me for that story, which was a very elite journal called the Partisan Review. And the response to that, which was tremendous, though it was a magazine with a circulation of no more than 2,000, I think, and I think I got $50 for it, that prompted a tremendous response from people around me. People in New York, I was living in New York at this time, who read it. And that was when I was encouraged to go all the way with the book and say, okay, you've got the beginnings. I had to rewrite bits of the first two chapters once they became chapters rather than stories. But this is the way to go. You're free. Well, there's no two words are more precious to a writer. I mean, than you're free.
It's interesting that it's by heading toward a taboo that you felt you're free. Do you know what I mean? Because what's more taboo? Or what was more taboo then than writing about masturbation? I mean,
well, I don't think it was the most taboo subject. I think it was writing about masturbation in a domestic Jewish situation.
Right. Taboo. Yeah, and add all that to it. Yeah.
Sure. Because if you think of Henry Miller, the book was banned here for many years, Tropic of Cancer. But there are things far more taboo. There's all trafficking with whores. There's all kinds of stuff. This was, the freedom came not from being a wild man. I was free because I'd found the vessel into which to put this stuff. That is, the vessel was the psychoanalytic session. There was my freedom because he's trying to solve a problem. And the problem has to do with something larger than masturbation. You didn't think you'd ever hear me say that, did you?
So what is the problem that you see it?
Well, it has to do with brutality, I think. The discovery of one's own brutality. Among those who were shocked and outraged, I think they were shocked and outraged by the revelation of brutality of feeling. I don't necessarily mean physical brutality. There is some of that in the book. Brutality of feeling, brutality of attitude, brutality of anger. the excesses that you say all this takes place in a Jewish family. That was what was shocking. That was the revelation that was shocking, not masturbation per se.
My guest is Philip Roth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Philip Roth. When we left off, we were talking about his novel, Portnoy's Complaint.
This book also became famous because of what it said about Jewish middle-class life or Jewish working-class life. Like, for instance, in writing about his father, he writes, he drank, of course, not whiskey like a goy, but mineral oil and milk of magnesia and chewed on Ex-Lax and ate all bran morning and night. He suffered, did he suffer, from constipation. And the sense of, you know, that like his father wasn't like macho, like, you know, he didn't drink whiskey, he drank milk of magnesia. That's one of the themes through the book. And the sense of like some things are goyish and some things are Jewish. And some of the things that were goyish, not Jewish, seemed much more desirable and exotic and romantic and manly and so on. Of course, you took a lot of heat for that, you know, from Jewish critics and Jewish readers who felt, you know, that you were insulting your own Jewishness and other people's too. Were you prepared for that? And was that something that you were concerned about at all in writing it? Or did you just want to, like, get that voice right?
With Portnoy's Complaint, I can't say that I wasn't prepared for something, because it was obviously... looked at one way, an act of provocation. But I just wrote it out, really. It was very fierce. I was called a lot of disgusting names that were false. I was called a Jew hater. I was called an anti-Semite. I was called a self-hater, and so on. This was offensive to me. Remains the people who made those comments remain offensive to me. I think I was talking about something that was, which was this kind of rage existed, this kind of defiance existed, this kind of anguish, by the way. I think one thing that's in the book is that must be noted is the anguish of this character. This comedy is a form of suffering, and otherwise I wouldn't be interested in it. It wasn't just a kind of stand-up routine or... anything like that.
Was your mother prepared for it? Because so many people must have assumed that the mother in your book was based on your mother. Mm-hmm. And so many Jewish mothers who didn't even read Portnoy's Complaint were offended by it. Mm-hmm. So how did your mother handle it?
I'm good at offending people who don't read the book. That's probably the strongest thing I do. Well, my mother and father were pretty good. I have to tell you, I had to prepare them. I felt I had to prepare them for the publication of this book. That was not something I had done with the previous three books. But before Portnoy's Complaint, I did have to prepare them, I thought, because it became clear as publication came upon us that it was going to be a big book. And we had lunch, and I said, look, this book is going to come out, and appears as though it's going to cause a sensation because it has the following ingredients in it. And I told them what they were. I said, and you are going to be telephoned by journalists, and you have no experience with that, and I want to prepare you for it. Number one is you don't have to talk to anybody. You can politely hang up or unpolitely hang up. They're just journalists, you know. And they'll be very nice to you, and they'll say flattering things to you, try to get you to talk, but you don't have to. I said, if you want to talk, that's fine with me too. But I want you to know you don't have to, and that you won't give offense to anyone if you don't. And you may be well advised not to, but it's finally up to you.
So did they?
Well, the story is better than that.
They
left the restaurant, and I didn't know this till after my mother died. My father and I were taking a walk. We took many walks after that, and he was telling me lots of things. They got into the taxi cab, and my mother burst into tears. My father said, "What's the matter?" He said, "He has delusions of grandeur." And I've never known him to be like, he's not like that, but he's going to be terribly, terribly disappointed. And my father would say, he knows what he's talking about or whatever. My mother said, no, I can't bear how hurt he's going to be when this doesn't happen. So that was her reaction. In fact, what happened was that they did get numerous phone calls, and they were polite and didn't say anything. I think my mother said one thing that was quoted by the New York Times. She just found it very difficult to hang up on the New York Times, you know? It's really quite easy. But she didn't know that. And she, in response to the question, the needling question about Jewish mothers and herself, she said, it was worthy of Pascal, really. She said, all mothers are Jewish mothers. That shut him up. So he was quoted in the New York Times as saying that. And I think there are many Christian mothers around America who may have taken real exception to that.
Philip Roth recorded in September after the publication of the first two volumes of a projected 8-volume collection of his works published by the Library of America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anne Bronte's neglected novel, Agnes Grey, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our week of our favorite interviews of 2005 continues with film director David Cronenberg. His latest film, A History of Violence, is showing up on many critics' 10 best lists. It was named Best Film of the Year in the Village Voice Critics Poll. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending 2005 with some of our favorite interviews of the year. I spoke to film director David Cronenberg in the fall when his film A History of Violence was released. It's showing up on a lot of critics' 10 best lists. In the Village Voice Critics Poll, it won Best Film of the Year, and Cronenberg won Best Director. Cronenberg's other films include Scanners, The Dead Zone, Videodrome, The Fly, Dead Ringers, and Naked Lunch. A History of Violence asks whether some people are inherently violent and whether they can change. The film stars Viggo Mortensen as Tom Stahl, a husband and father who owns a diner in a small town in Indiana. He becomes a hero when he kills two armed robbers who are threatening the lives of everyone in the diner. Soon after, a mysterious man with a scarred face shows up at the diner, claiming that Tom isn't who he says he is. The mysterious man is played by Ed Harris.
Well, welcome to Stalls. Would you gentlemen like some coffee?
You're the hero.
I don't know, sir.
You're the big hero. Sure took care of those two bad men.
Really don't like talking about it, sir. We're trying to get back to normal here. So can I offer you gentlemen some coffee?
Sure. Give me some coffee. Make it black.
Yes, sir.
Joey.
And your friends?
They don't drink coffee. He doesn't agree with them. Joey.
Joey.
My
name's Tom, sir.
Of course it is.
David Cronenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. A history
Thanks.
Of violence is basically saying that everyone, or at least most people, have the potential to be violent, but some people are forced to become violent to fight a bully, whereas others just seem to have a taste for it. Do you believe that most people do have that potential?
Well, I think it's innate in us, just genetically, that we are capable of violence. But in specific cases, you have to go on a case-by-case basis. But I think in the movie, we're really examining the ambivalent attitude that people have towards violence. It's, you know, you sort of don't want it to come and visit you in your house. But on the other hand, you might find it rather exhilarating when you see it visited on other people, either in the movies or alive. So the movie is a meditation on that ambivalence rather than, you know, saying anything very specific about genetics, let's say.
Well, you know, talking about that ambivalence about violence, I think movies themselves reflect that because violent movies are incredibly popular. People seem to like violent scenes in movies. At the same time, there's always these kind of attempts to crack down against violence in movies and, you know, mm-hmm. fear that violence in movies will lead to violence in real life. How does that whole infatuation with violence in movies, how did that affect your style of shooting the violent sequences?
Well, rather than having an overarching theory of where violence in cinema should go or shouldn't go, or even thinking about my old movies and what people expect from me or don't expect from me, getting rid of all that, I think only about what is in this movie. And in it, I say, okay, where does the violence come from? Well, it comes from specific characters. What does the violence mean to those characters? Where did they learn to be violent? That's really was the ruling factor in deciding how to portray it. And I came to the conclusion that for these people, I'm quoting a line from the movie, business would come first. You know, it's business for them. It's a criminal enterprise. It's not sadistic pleasure. It's not ballet. It's not aesthetics. It's not martial arts. It's business. Get it over with. Get it done. If you have to kill somebody or hurt somebody, you do it as efficiently as possible. And normally using techniques that you've learned on the street. You know, you haven't been trained professionally. You haven't been in the army or anything like that. So that was the tone that I gave to the violence in the movie. And it's very intimate. The theory being that when you want to kill someone, you get close to them. You don't get far away from them. You actually get as close to them as you can. So the violence in the movie is very, very short and quick and realistic. No slow motion, no multiple cuts and so on. And it's very strangely intimate and very physical.
What did you have to learn about guns and fighting in order to direct the film?
Well, I really started only learning about guns through movies because in Canada, you know, we have very strict gun laws, gun control laws, and I actually never held a pistol in my hand until I was making a movie, actually. And in terms of killing on the street, well, I did find a couple of DVDs on the internet that purport to teach you how to do exactly that, you know, how to kill somebody with your bare hands if you're attacked, mugged, robbed. And that was also one of the places where I found that sense of intimacy with the person that you're trying to kill. The whole idea of those was that you move into the person. You don't step away so that they can shoot you or stab you or whatever. You actually get close to them so that you can touch them, feel them, smell them, see their sweat, see their pores. And from that vantage point, you actually are much more capable of inflicting damage and surprise on an attacker than you would think.
Was it kind of creepy to be watching this DVD about how to kill someone?
Well, it's presented in a very matter-of-fact, pragmatic kind of way, you know, with a great patina of professionalism and so on. There wasn't just one, it was several. So it kind of decreases the creepiness.
The presumption is you're the innocent victim who's
learning how to kill in self-defense,
and you're a good guy. No bad guys are watching this DVD.
That's right, and you're getting, you're seeing testimonials from old age pensioners in Miami, you know, who are saying, "I feel much more secure walking down the street now that I know I can kill." You know, so it kind of takes the sinisterness out of it, which in a way makes it even more sinister, I suppose. And of course, I have no idea whether I could ever do that based on what I saw or not. You know, I mean, and certainly one hopes never to have to figure that out.
Now, A History of Violence is, it's kind of like a Western, and in part because there's a character in it who has renounced violence but is forced back into it in the way that a lot of characters in Westerns have been, like Johnny Guitar, you know, the guy who gives up guns but has to pick them up again because of threats against him and someone mm-hmm. he loves. Was your style of shooting this movie inspired by Westerns?
Not really the style, but certainly one of the things that attracted me to the project was that kind of iconic Americana tone that there is. And it's not just Westerns, but gangster movies as well. And it's kind of, you know, America's mythology of itself, which it has very successfully exported to the rest of the world through its movies and its art and so on. The man standing alone with the gun, protecting himself and his family against the bad guys and taking vengeance and having that be very justified because of what he is. And taking the law into his own hands is another very American theme, which is not particularly obvious in other countries, including Canada. You know, the idea that you, at a certain moment of crisis, you must take the law into your own hands, that sense of individualism and righteousness, the righteousness of the individual is foreign to many countries, most countries, I would say.
There's two sex scenes in A History of Violence that are both very passionate. And one of them is kind of playful and about role-playing, and the other is much more in anger and in violence, but still very, very passionate. Actors, and both scenes reveal a lot about the characters. Actors are always talking about how difficult it is to perform the sex scenes and how self-conscious they are and uncomfortable. What about directing scenes like that? What are the challenges in directing them?
Well, the vulnerability, both physically and psychologically, of actors in a sex scene is probably pretty obvious to most people, but there is the same thing going on with the director. You know, if a director is very sexually inhibited or repressed or shy or embarrassed or anything else, it inevitably is communicated to the crew and to the actors, and it makes them be the same, and therefore you don't get a very good scene, probably. So it's really a matter of being funny, being loose, being specific, giving the actors the sense that you know what you're doing. In my case, I make sure that the actors can look at a monitor and see the recordings of what they just shot at any moment, so they know exactly what they look like and what's going on. No secrets, no surprises to hit them later. And it's just being very gentle and supportive, you know, and still, of course, getting what we want, but never letting go until we've got what we want. There's a scene on the stairs, sex on the stairs, very hard wooden stairs between Vigo and Maria Bello. That was physically very difficult, too, because they were both actually quite battered and bruised after that, because it took a day and a half to shoot that. And those were real wooden stairs. And at one point, I asked my stunt coordinator if he had stunt pads, and he laughed. He said he'd never been asked for stunt pads for a sex scene before. But in fact, we couldn't use them because, you know, you'd see them. So they had to do them without them. But yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think some directors are very inhibited, and you can tell it gets communicated.
Is it hard to not feel like, you know, you're a voyeur or a peeping Tom when you're setting up a scene like that?
You are totally a voyeur and a peeping Tom, and it's better if you just admit it. You know, that I mean, you because at that point you are the audience as well, and you are watching. You're watching sex. I mean, it's not real sex, but you're watching a simulation of sex. So this is something, once again, that is joked about on my set. I mean, we all are in on the joke. There's no, you know, nobody who's not. So all of those aspects of it are out in the open, and there's no, you know, nothing's covered up.
My guest is director David Cronenberg. His latest film is A History of Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is director David Cronenberg. His films include Scanners, The Dead Zone, Dead Ringers, The Fly, and Naked Lunch. His latest film is A History of Violence. I really like the opening shot of the movie, and when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And in the opening shot, two guys are walking out the door of a motel room, and they're walking into bright sunlight, and they really have to squint. The sunlight really hits them. And you can tell that they've come from a world that's, like, really dark, into this bright light, and you figure there's something really dark about these guys, and there certainly is. Can you talk about what you try to do in an opening shot to establish the tone, the mood? Because how important do you think that opening shot is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This movie, I don't have an opening title sequence that's separate from the movie, and I've often talked about my enjoying doing that. That is to say, making a title sequence that isn't a scene from the movie, so that people are not put in the position of reading titles and watching the movie at the same time, and using that title sequence as a kind of vestibule, you know, to kind of ease the audience into the movie from being in their own world, and using that title sequence to set a tone that will set them up for the movie. In this case, I shot that scene, and it's a single shot that lasts for 4 minutes, and it's quite complex little shot with dollying and craning and a few other things. Not for spectacle, it's quite tight and intimate, but it does go through some very difficult little moments. And there's a kind of strange, languidly sinister tone to these two guys, and they take their time talking, and I don't rush them. A lot of space between the words and so on. And I really liked that tone so much that even though I did shoot coverage for it, which is to say did other close-ups and so on so that I could tighten the scene or whatever by cutting into it, I thought that the single shot worked so well that way that I would leave it and not cut into it. And at that point I thought, well, here's a perfect opening scene that I think I could put titles over in a way that I haven't done for many, many years. And then, therefore, this shot would have to do two things. It would have to be the first scene in the movie, and it would have to have that vestibule effect that I normally use a title sequence to get. That is, it would be a scene that would tell the audience a lot about what they were getting into with this movie. And interestingly enough, too, there's no music over this shot, which is also, I think, rather rare these days. Howard Shore, the composer, he composed some pieces to try over this opening scene. And whatever we did, it gave too much away. It pointed in a direction. And the scene itself is so kind of sinisterly directionless that it was actually better to have no music there. So it turned out to be, I think, quite an important shot and quite important sequence for the movie, because it does set up really an awful lot the more you think about it.
You've written some of the movies you've directed, but A History of Violence is an adaptation of a graphic novel. You were approached with the screen adaptation of the graphic novel and decided to direct the film. Is there a difference for you in how you approach material that you've written as opposed to approaching material that you have not? And I'm wondering, in a way, if you feel freer to take liberties with either of the two.
No, I feel free to take liberties with everything. You know, I mean, to me, that's what I have to do. My first adaptation that was The Dead Zone, an adaptation of a Stephen King bestseller. And before that, all of the movies I had made, I'd written myself. They were original screenplays. And I felt that I immediately became obvious to me that in order to be faithful to that book, I had to betray the book. In other words, there is no way of translating a book to the screen because the two media are so completely different. There is no dictionary for that translation. You know, you really have to reinvent it totally for the screen. And what you do is you try to capture the ambience, you know, this tone of the book, rather than be faithful literally, because if you try to do it literally faithfully, you're doomed to failure. So taking liberties with adapted material was as necessary as when you've written it yourself.
I'm glad you mentioned The Dead Zone. This starred Christopher Walken as somebody who, when he touches someone, he can see their future. And this was relatively early in Walken's career. And since then, you know, a lot of comics and impressionists have affectionately mocked his very strange pattern of speaking where accents fall on very unlikely words within sentences. Were you aware of that when you were directing him, and did that throw you at all?
No, I mean, I think it's a brilliant performance. He had won an Oscar at that point.
For The Deer Hunter,
mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a fine actor.
Oh, and yeah, he's great.
Yeah, you know, but every actor has a specific kind of rhythm and diction, and you develop a relationship in the editing room with the actor that's a unique relationship. Nobody has that relationship other than a director who's editing an actor, because you live with that diction for, well, weeks or months that you're editing the movie. And you become so attuned to that. When Chris wakes up from his coma in the Dead Zone, and they tell him that he's been gone for 5 years, he says, 5 years. There was just a wonderful, the surprise, you know, the shock and the horror of it all was expressed just in those two words, and it was the rhythm between the two words, just having two words to work with, that expressed that, and it was just fantastic.
You've made a lot of films with very dark and potent fantasies in them, and I want to quote something that you've said. You've said As an artist, one is not a citizen of society. An artist is bound to explore every aspect of human experience, the darkest concerns. You cannot worry about what the structure of your own particular segment of society considers bad behavior or good behavior. You have no social responsibility whatsoever. First of all, do you still agree with that?
Absolutely, I do.
Why do you think it's important for an artist to not be inhibited when it comes to exploring the darkest parts of their imagination?
Well, society does not tend to encourage people to tell the truth. Society is, in general, is interested in sustaining itself, and that includes whatever fictions, facades, or hypocrisies that society needs to sustain itself. So you are not encouraged really to tell the truth. You're encouraged to be a good citizen in the bad sense, which is to say an obedient citizen, one who toes the line, one who sort of accepts the standards of society without question. And this is a natural thing. All societies have this kind of gyroscopic need to sustain themselves, maintain themselves, and that imparts a certain stability. But at the same time, if you only go with that, then you never get improvements, you never get corrections of injustices and so on. So you need the words of the, you know, the rebels, the artists, the people who are who will not accept reality as it is presented, but figure that there's something else going on. There's something other things going. I don't mean I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm talking about looking for the truth about the way things work and how those things might be improved. So you need both forces, though. You know, for civilization, you need both of them. I mean, in the Freudian formula, civilization is repression. You know, repression of the most basic, base, primitive instincts. But you don't get civilization without a rebellion against repression as well, as in the Freudian formula that will come from the unconscious and dreams and so on.
So are you working under the premise that most people have very dark thoughts or fantasies that they wouldn't admit to in public, and that it's in part your job to talk about those things that people have, but they won't necessarily say that they do?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you imagine just taking anybody asleep and drilling a hole in their forehead and having their dreams projected onto a screen for a couple of thousand people as though it were an entertainment, what do you think you'd see from anybody? You know, I think you'd see some pretty, you'd see some boring stuff, but I think you'd see some amazing things as well, you know, perhaps quite shocking, and it would come from straight citizens of all kinds, you know, and it's all there.
A couple of your movies are almost about that, like Scanners in a way.
Yeah,
almost,
I mean,
operates
that
on that principle.
Yeah, there is a hole drilled in a forehead in Scanners, and I suppose I've been taking that my metaphor that I just gave you from that.
My guest is director David Cronenberg. His latest film is A History of Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is director David Cronenberg. His films include Scanners, The Dead Zone, Dead Ringers, The Fly, and Naked Lunch. His latest film is A History of Violence. You've done several horror films. I mean, they're not standard horror films, but they're like your take on horror films. And you've said that the horror in horror films is about the inevitability of death. Do you think your understanding of death and your way of addressing it has changed as you've gotten older?
Well, I think my understanding has gotten deeper and more profound. Yeah, I think so. I don't know that that really necessarily will change the way that I deal with death in films. I said very early on that, I think as early as Scanners, I seem to recall saying to somebody, every time I kill somebody in my movie, I'm really rehearsing my own death, you know, or like a trial run to see how it would feel, to see how I would feel. And I think there's still some truth in that. You know, that's why I don't take death lightly in my films. It's always a very significant event.
Does it give you a sense of control to be directing a death scene? Because we really have no control over death. But as a director, for those moments, you do.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that directors become directors and actors become actors. It's imagine the sense of control you have as an actor to sort of die doing 10 takes in a movie, and then you get up and you're still alive. You know, it gives you a feeling of some kind of immortality, even though you know it's a false sense, and it gives you a feeling that perhaps in some way you will be more prepared for your own death, having rehearsed it so many times.
Are there scenes in movies that you saw when you were young that disturbed you, that you were afraid to go to sleep afterwards, or those images would kind of come up and bother you, and you couldn't get rid of them?
Oh, sure. Bambi.
Bambi.
Terrifying.
With the fire?
Terrifying.
The fire?
Terrifying. Oh, and the death of the parents, you know. Mm-hmm. Dumbo. You know, the scene where Dumbo is being separated from his mother. Because these are things that censors who are worried about what children can take and what they can't take seem never to understand, is that a child's perspective on things is quite different from an adult. And separation from the parents is one of the huge traumatic things that exists in a kid's mind. And so I can say that the original Blue Lagoon movie, not the Brooke Shields one, the one way earlier with John Hall, there were scenes in that. That was the movie that made me sleep with the lights on for a week. It's about a couple of kids who are on a boat. The boat catches fire and sinks, and the kids are the only ones left alive, and they swim to this nearby island, and they grow up in isolation on the island. But it's the fact that they're alone, you know, that their parents have died. That was the terrifying thing about that movie for me.
David Cronenberg recorded in October. His latest film, A History of Violence, is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of A Briefer History of Time, an updated and revised edition by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow, available in hardcover. From Work Song, Rhino, and Starbucks, presenting I Believe to My Soul, a CD featuring 5 soul artists. Information at starbucks.com/hearmusic. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering bachelor's, MBA, master's, and doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, more of our favorite interviews from 2005. Gene Wilder talks about working with Mel Brooks on The Producers and Young Frankenstein and his marriage to Gilda Radner. And musicians Branford Marsalis and Harry Connick Jr. reminisce about growing up in New Orleans. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.